Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we get to talk with Assistant Professor and Program Director for the Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation Residency at UNC, Dr. Heather Walker, about traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, this is like such a critical issue, Christy, because we increasingly recognize that mild concussions over repeated times can be a serious lifelong problem. So I'm so excited to have Dr. Walker here to talk about this.
I am too, but first we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about differences in race and ethnicity on whether people get antibiotics.
About if you have hepatitis C, can you have a beer every now and then?
About the consequences for false positive screening on a mammogram to women's mental health.
Yeah, something we don't probably pay enough attention to. And finally, if you have diabetes, would you do better in your own control if you have someone else who has diabetes talking with you about how they control their diabetes? Very interesting. Let's listen. Let's talk about our very first research that matters, Christy, about this antibiotics and ethnicity.
Yeah. So this was a study looking at the health records of more than 200,000 children to look at children who came in for a sort of acute or sick visits to the doctor, whether or not they were prescribed antibiotics. This was published in the journal Pediatrics very recently.
Right, and what they found is that the African-American children were taken to the doctor about once per year with an acute kind of upper respiratory problem compared to the non-African-American children who went there twice a year. But after controlling for all the different factors that might impact on whether they got antibiotics or not, it turned out that the African-American children were prescribed antibiotics less likely, only 24% of the time, compared to the non-African-American children who got antibiotics 29% of the time.
Well, and the other interesting part was that it even worked down to the same doctor. So each individual doctor was more likely to prescribe antibiotics to the non-African-American or the white children more often than they did the African-American children. But the other little twist on this is it sounds like, oh, well, those children were not getting as good a care. But in fact, we know, Adam, and we talk about all the time on the show, over-prescribing of antibiotics is a major problem. So instead of one group getting less care, most likely what's happened here is that the other group got over-prescribed antibiotics. What
yeah,
do you think?
I don't know what even to call this, Christy, other than, oh, you know, the African-American children may be getting better care here, but I don't think it's because the doctors are consciously giving better care.
No.
I think that there is a bias here, and it just happens to favor this time less prescribing, but it also could work the other way and usually does. So I'm not totally reassured here. I think that they're, you know, for whatever reason, physicians like you and I may be having subtle biases about whether, you know, we're offering the antibiotics the same amount, and we need to be aware of that, even though we should be reducing antibiotics all the way across the board.
It's true. And it's, you know, yet another study showing that there are biases and discrimination that happens in the medical community. Although I think we're making headway, we really need to be concerned and to address it.
Well, let's move on to our next research that matters, about a very interesting article that looks at people who have chronic liver disease, like hepatitis C, and can they actually have anything to drink? Because I don't think I would have known that answer.
Yeah, and I think, you know, most people, most doctors would think, okay, if you've got a chronic liver infection like hepatitis C that can lead to cirrhosis or scarring of the liver, then probably drinking a lot is not a great idea because that can also lead to scarring of the liver. But this really looks at, I mean, almost 9,000 people to to without hepatitis C, comparing with 218 people who have it, to see what happens with their drinking patterns.
And they tracked those participating in the study for over a decade, and almost 20% of those with hepatitis C, compared to only 10% of those without hepatitis C, died. But that those who had the hepatitis C and who drank three or more drinks a day were much more likely, five times more likely to die than those who had hepatitis C but didn't drink heavily.
Yeah, I mean, I think the message really should be that patients who have hepatitis C really just shouldn't drink. There's not a reason to drink, and limiting that to as little as possible or not drinking at all is really the safest thing to do.
Yeah, even those who drink two or fewer drinks a day among hepatitis C, their risk of dying was 74 times that of people who were their age who drank that amount but didn't have hepatitis C. So huge risk factor. It'll change what I prescribe to a large number of people.
I would agree. Let's talk about mammograms. So we know there's been a lot of concern and some changes in recommendations about at what age women should get mammograms and higher false positive rates if you get mammograms in your 40s, and some different recommendations about whether or not people should be getting mammograms in their 40s.
There's some confusion and conflicting recommendations of the U.S. Preventive Task Force, which doesn't recommend these screening exams start until age 50 if you don't have any high-risk problems, versus the American Cancer Society that recommends earlier screening and more frequent screening. And I think what this research that was in the Annals of Family Medicine shows is that it potentially really matters, not necessarily for when you diagnose breast cancer, but when you have a false positive.
So they followed people for 3 years, about 450 women who had abnormal findings on their screening mammogram.
That false positive, right?
Yeah. So, and they found that the people who had the false positive findings, even 3 years out, had changes in their values about life and their inner calmness. Almost as great as the people who had the diagnosis of cancer.
Yeah, in the first 6 months, and even after several years, their calmness and distress, it was not as high as those who had breast cancer. We wouldn't expect that, but it was significantly more than those who didn't have the false positives. So for me, Christy, this is a big take-home message, which is that screening is not a benign, it's not a simple issue, because you do have a lot of false positives, unfortunately, and we don't usually talk about the consequences of those.
Well, and, you know, it's part of my counseling of patients to go through potential false positives, that they're higher in your 40s and need to think about how you'll react to that. It takes a lot of time. This reinforces for me that those conversations are really important to do before someone makes a decision about whether or not to get mammograms in those early years.
Right, and these were on 12 different scales of psychological and social things of importance to patients. So have a conversation with your doctor, ask about this possibility, and then make an informed decision about what's right for you.
The last research that matters we have is about coaching from peers who have diabetes to help low-income patients control their blood sugar.
Yeah, this research, Christy, I also like it because it was not only was in the Annals of Family Medicine, some of our colleagues, but it was a randomized controlled trial in 6 public health clinics in San Francisco, and it wasn't necessarily a large study, but 150 patients that were given kind of health coaches, people who also had diabetes, whose blood sugars were better controlled than the patients who didn't, or these other patients who had diabetes, compared to people who didn't get this health coaching. And then did this help those who got coaching's blood sugars to decrease?
And they found that at 6 months, the hemoglobin A1C, or the test that really gives an idea of the average blood sugar over the past 6 weeks, those numbers decreased by a whole point for the people who were in the coach group, who had a peer with diabetes counsel them, and only decreased by a fraction of a point in the usual care group.
Well, that'll conclude our research that matters. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to talk with Dr. Heather Walker. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Assistant Professor and Program Director for University of North Carolina Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation Program at University of North Carolina about traumatic brain injuries with Dr. Heather Walker. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Walker.
Thank you for having me.
We are so glad to have you have this conversation. I think as parents, as providers, as friends, as, you know, people who've been bumped over the head a time or two in our lives, this is an important conversation and really is pertinent to almost everyone to think about what is traumatic brain injury and what are the potential effects of that. Tell us how you got involved in this work.
Well, I specialize primarily in neurotrauma, so that includes both traumatic brain injuries and spinal cord injuries. I found that during my residency training, I really enjoyed the neurotrauma side of things, of rehabilitation, more than the musculoskeletal impacts. It's just inspiring to see the patients kind of dealing with these significant injuries and having good outcomes in a number of cases. So it's a lot of fun to work with these patients.
Well, when we talk about people having traumatic brain injuries, and I can imagine that some patients or many with spinal cord injuries might have also traumatic brain injuries. What are we really talking about? And that term is not one that, when I went through medical school in the 1930s, this wasn't a term we were using. I don't even know what term we were using, but I know we weren't talking about traumatic brain injury.
Okay, so a traumatic brain injury would include anything such as a closed head injury, any trauma that causes some type of damage to the brain, whether it's a closed head injury or a penetrating injury such as a gunshot wound or a stab wound to the brain, as opposed to other causes of brain injury such as vascular blood supply type abnormalities or strokes, metabolic impairments, lack of oxygen, anoxic brain injury. So it's more of a direct trauma to the head that causes the injury.
And so when you're talking about closed head injuries, you're talking about things like concussions?
Sure.
And what other types of are there, or concussions is some subset of this traumatic brain injury? Explain how that relates.
So depending on some kind of clinical indicators, a patient can be classified as having a mild, moderate, or severe traumatic brain injury, and a concussion would fall into the mild range. And most concussions are not associated with CT, like CAT scan findings, such as intracranial hemorrhages or
they're not bleeding
fractures
in the brain.
Right, exactly. So no bleeding in the brain typically, although there is a subset of concussions that are classified as a complicated mild traumatic brain injury in which you might see some findings with bleeding in the brain.
You know, one of the things I was really amazed with looking at the statistics is that there are almost 1.5 million cases of traumatic brain injury in the United States every year. That was many more than I would have expected. Where are they all coming from? They're not all coming from football, are they? Or hockey?
No, I mean, there are a lot of ways to have a traumatic brain injury. It could be sports related. It could be motor vehicle crash related. And it's difficult to really quantify the exact number of patients with traumatic brain injuries because most don't seek medical treatment. We're only seeing a subset in the emergency departments and as far as people who present for medical treatment after a traumatic brain injury. And I myself only see the worst of the worst because I treat primarily inpatients who typically they have moderate or severe level traumatic brain injuries rather than the mild traumatic brain injuries that we see with concussions.
Well, maybe we should walk through a little bit from mild to moderate to severe and give us perhaps an example. So with a mild person, if they had a, you know, hit the soccer ball or got banged up in sports and banged their head in some way, what kinds of symptoms might they present with versus as you progress along to a more significant trauma?
Sure. So folks with a more mild traumatic brain injury or concussion may have difficulties with feeling a little mentally fuzzy or hazy for a period of time after the brain injury. They can have post-traumatic headaches. They can have vestibular or balance issues and those types of kind of symptoms that go along with the brain injury.
And then something that was more significant, you would find other problems with movement, or give us some examples of those types of problems.
Sure. So someone with a more moderate or severe type of brain injury, it really depends on the area of the brain that is damaged. But as you mentioned, the patients can have difficulties with weakness or spasticity, meaning muscle tightness in their affected extremities. They can have more significant cognitive deficits. They can have difficulties with speech and language communication. So a whole host of kind of physical findings, along with a lot of medical complications that we typically see in these patients.
You know, this whole area of traumatic brain injuries is one of these things that I think so many families have some experience with, unfortunately. I'm thinking about, you know, my daughter, who the grandfather was holding on the shoulders and fell backwards and hit her head, and you know, had a skull fracture, but you know, did well. And then my own slipping on ice and hitting my head and falling and having a concussion. Is this a uniform thing that has always been there, or do you think that we are now uncovering more of it because we're better at diagnosing it?
I think that we're recognizing it more now than we did previously. Back in the day, people would have a sports injury and just go right back into play. But now we're recognizing that
A headache was okay.
Yeah, a headache was okay. You're a little bit groggy, but it's okay. You can go back into play if you know the score of the game.
But we're winning.
Exactly. But now we're trying to be aware of the fact that if that person goes back in for repeat play and has a repeat head injury, it can be devastating, and the recovery can be much less ideal.
And so I imagine one of the levels of getting the word out is around sports. You mentioned sports and car crashes and other things, but what kind of steps can we start to take as families, as parents, to try to prevent traumatic brain injury, but also encourage our children to be active?
Wearing helmets is definitely one of the things that we should be encouraging our kids to do when they're riding bikes or riding skateboards, riding ATVs, those types of things if they choose to engage in those activities. But in sports, unfortunately, you know, football, you have helmets. There have been some devices that have been tested in soccer players to try to prevent concussions, but there hasn't been really anything specifically in that sport that has shown to be effective in preventing concussions. So I think it's important to be aware that these kids are at risk for concussions and to be aware of the symptoms that are associated with it and pull the kid out of the game if they are suffering from the effects of a concussion.
Wow.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, let's talk about the types of rehabilitation and the types of treatment and the type of research that is happening and how you work together in teams to help people with traumatic brain injuries. We're going to take a short break, but we'll continue with our guest, Dr. Heather Walker, about traumatic brain injuries. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Payne.
Need your local culture fix? The lifestyle section of chapelboro.com is the only place to go for food and dining, restaurant views, health tips, fashion, and local culture commentary. Want to know what the best shows and venues to attend? Lifestyle has show listings for Deepak, Cat's Cradle, and the Art Center, and many more. And be sure to check back after the show for reviews and commentary. There's even information on local neighborhoods and schools. Keep yourself in style with Chapelboro's Lifestyle.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We have been talking with Dr. Heather Walker from UNC Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation and the Residency Program Director there at UNC about traumatic brain injury. And, you know, Dr. Walker, you talked a bit about some prevention strategies with helmets and responding early to children or athletes who are injured in a game, pulling them out of play. But once somebody has a significant traumatic brain injury, how do you approach that? Maybe give us an example of a patient story with something that happened significant and how, you know, what kind of treatment plans or rehabilitation plans might you come up with?
So we see patients with moderate and severe traumatic brain injuries in the inpatient rehabilitation center at UNC all the time. You know, unfortunately, it's pretty common, and patients who suffer that degree of injury typically aren't to the point where they can be discharged directly to home in the care of their families. They need more of an interdisciplinary team approach. So we try to admit them to inpatient rehab where we can have them working with physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech and language pathologists, and recreational therapists on a daily basis to really maximize their functional recovery. And we have the advantage that they are in the hospital, so they're seeing a physician on a daily basis, so we can manage some of the medical complications that go along with a brain injury, such as sleep-wake cycle disorders, agitation, cardiovascular complications that can occur. So it's a really great team approach to get the patient to the maximal function so that they can go home safely with their families.
So let's talk about the kind of the prognosis. I mean, you've had someone who's had a severe enough brain injury to require treatment in the hospital for an extended period of time and then in rehabilitation. Presumably they have problems maybe with speech, with memory, with concentration, with sleep. What's the prognosis here? Because I think many of us might believe that it's really not good.
There are a fair number of people who do have residual deficits after their traumatic brain injuries. But kind of the joke among those of us who treat a lot of traumatic brain injuries, we say if you've seen one traumatic brain injury, you've seen one traumatic brain injury, because they all present differently, and the prognosis is going to depend on a multitude of variables, including the patient's age, the severity of the injury, and kind of their ongoing medical treatment.
Someone who's younger does better?
Yeah, younger, typically they do better than the older individuals.
And, help us understand for our lay listeners and for those of us who aren't brain specialists, what do you need to know or learn about the brain to really understand how it might recover or not recover as you're trying to give a family a picture of what's ahead?
Well, it's important for the families to know that the recovery is kind of a slow, ongoing process, and they need to be able to recognize the different phases of recovery after a brain injury. And it can be very difficult for the families to see their patients in a coma initially, and they'll pass through these different stages of recovery, and oftentimes they'll become very agitated and combative, and family members are, you know, they're very concerned when they see that because this is not the personality of their loved one, and it's just something that they don't recognize. But to educate them on the fact that it's a normal progression as they go from a lower level of consciousness where they're in a coma or kind of a minimally conscious state up through the agitated scales, and they will eventually, hopefully, get to be to a more appropriate level of consciousness where they can fully participate in their therapies and make a more functional recovery. We don't know everything that goes into it as far as the neurotransmitter levels, the levels of chemicals in the brain. You know, we know that acutely there's a surge of these chemicals, and in the subacute period, they can decrease, and there are some medications that we can use to try to help augment the recovery based on these chemical levels. And we try to educate the families on that as we go on a daily basis.
And I imagine that this is a pretty interdisciplinary. You must be working and kind of shepherding a team of occupational speech, physical therapists, social workers, psychologist. Speak for a moment about how this works or doesn't work in our healthcare reform system. Are we doing better today than we were 5-10 years ago, do you think?
Well, I've only been on faculty for about 5 years, so I can speak to that. You know, as far as the way that we work in a team, that is something that we really do a good job of, I think, in rehabilitation medicine. That's kind of the whole premise of our specialty, is that the physiatrist, the physician, is kind of overseeing the team approach. But everyone plays an equal role, from the rehab nursing specialist to PT, OT, speech, our neuropsychologist, recreational therapist. So we're all working to the benefit of the patient.
What's the recreational therapist do?
So our recreational therapists work a lot on various different things, community reintegration, relaxation, and pain management with non-pharmacological, non-medication techniques. So, for example, we have a patient who is on our unit right now, had a pretty significant brain injury, and she still has a lot of safety awareness issues and impulsivity issues. So we'll take her, the recreational therapist will take her to the grocery store to try and help her navigate around the grocery store. They'll take her on the bus line and make her, you know, do transfers on the bus line to practice these real-life skills that she'll need once she is able to get out of our rehab facility.
As you're looking ahead to the next 5-10 years, what's on the horizon for traumatic brain injury? I mean, will we learn enough about the brain that we can help promote its healing or regrowth? Or am I thinking, you know, are we not even close?
You know, there's always the talk about neuroplasticity, so kind of the brain reorganizing to take over functions of adjacent parts of the brain that might be damaged. And hopefully in the future, we'll find ways to augment that neuroplasticity and that recovery. You know, a lot of the work that's done acutely is more on the neurosurgical side, since they're managing the patients at admission and in the ICU, and we see them more in the rehab phase. So, you know, we're trying to find all the time better ways to rehabilitate these patients to maximize their functional outcomes.
One last quick question. Airbags in cars, have they helped reduce, or are they causing more traumatic brain injury?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, I'm not sure of the correct answer to that. I would assume that they are probably helping to reduce the significance of traumatic brain injuries.
The really bad ones.
Right.
Moderate, severe ones that you see in the hospital.
Exactly.
Well, we certainly want to thank you for the work that you're doing for our patients and coordinating their care and helping them rehabilitate, and for taking time to share it with us. We will certainly post this information, and if you have a trusted website or other sort of helpful tips for our listeners, we'd love to post that on our blog.
Okay, thank you.
Coming up on Health Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Are you looking for new customers? Try Our Local Deal, brought to you by WCHL and the Chapel Hill Carrboro Chamber of Commerce. You offer a deal to the community from your business, and folks purchase it. Everybody loves a deal. With Our Local Deal, your company or organization is featured on 97.9 FM WCHL, on the site at ourlocaldeal.com, and through social media. Want to try the best marketing deal in town? Visit ourlocaldeal.com or call us at 919-933-4165.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we get to spend some time talking about your questions and concerns and things that you've written to us.
If you have a question you want us to address on an upcoming show, Christy and I be happy to make comments. Please send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some really great house calls today, but difficult ones about a colon cancer discovered maybe because someone didn't get the screening test.
About COPD or lung disease.
About someone who, on the good side, lost a lot of weight. Maybe their diabetes got better.
And about being ticklish.
Which is not a laughing matter for the people involved by any means. So let's listen to our very first house call.
My uncle is 61 and decided after rejecting for 6 years to get a colonoscopy. He unfortunately had cancer and will need surgery. I just hope that others who should get a screening colon exam do not put it off like he did.
This is such a hard, hard thing to hear.
It really is. And, you know, colonoscopy is one of those things that is very well proven to be a great preventive measure for people for colon cancer because it can detect the cancer a lot of times before the cancer is even there, when it's a polyp, before it actually becomes cancer, and remove it, which cures it before it ever happened. But in this case, by delaying it, it sounds like that was... you know, that they found a really significant cancer after it's already there.
And there's a lot of reasons why people might not get a colonoscopy. It can be very expensive, and people may not can afford it. It is invasive.
And lots of people don't like the prep.
Yeah, and you got to go and take a day off of work. I mean, there's a lot of reasons. There are, though, other accepted colon cancer screening tests, maybe not the best, but they are accepted. So even if you couldn't have a colonoscopy, I would have hoped that these other screening tests could have been offered or done.
And those are screening tests like fecal occult blood testing, where you have a little kit to be able to test your stool for any blood. And also a flexible sigmoidoscopy, which is like a colonoscopy, just doesn't go as far.
Yeah, so we encourage you to have those conversations, to talk about, and to try to prevent what could be a preventable cancer. And we're sorry about this, but we do hope that there are good treatments that are available for your uncle. Thank you for your question.
Absolutely. Let's take our next house call.
If you have really bad COPD, how do you decide if you should go on a respirator or not?
That's a tough question, Christy.
That is, and I think that you mean the respirator or like a ventilator, like being intubated and on the breathing machine if you were in the hospital. So I guess we should respond with that in mind, Adam.
Yeah, you know, this is really hard because we do know that chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, the COPD, generally does tend to get worse and people's lung function tends to decline. And at some point in time, it may get bad enough that if you actually had to go on a respirator to continue to breathe, you might not ever come off that respirator. And that's what people are really fearful of. And that's a hard problem.
It is. And it's hard to predict in advance what that would be like. There are some things in the hospital, like a mask, something called BiPAP, or some ways to provide something like a respirator or a ventilator without having the full tube down your throat and on the machine, that sometimes can be sort of a middle ground to hold you over to help you try to get better and see if you're going to turn around. But you want to have these conversations openly with your doctor, preferably before you get so sick.
And sometimes if you have a pneumonia that could be reversed in a week or two, sometimes people would say it's reasonable to go on a respirator. We don't know if you get off or not, but that's reversible a lot of times. So perhaps the severity of the lung disease, having these honest conversations, and what are your values, these are important things.
Well, let's take our next house call about being ticklish.
I am a young female who is incredibly ticklish. I cannot stand for anyone to touch me almost anywhere. Obviously, this interferes with dating and touching. I would appreciate some suggestions.
Well, Christy, this is actually a very difficult problem. I did not know this, but there is a medical term for being incredibly ticklish. Have you ever heard of this?
I have not heard of the medical term.
It's called hypergargalesthesia, and there are two types of hypergargalesthesia.
Tell me.
There's one called kinesmesis, K-N-I-S-M-E-S-I-S, and gargalesis, G-A-R-G-A-L-E-S-I-S, founded in 1897 about these two types of tickling where, you know, a feather goes under your chin and you just kind of are ants crawling across you and you notice that and you brush it off compared to the uncontrollable laughing. That's the gargalesis. That's really, really hard for people who are hypersensitive to really stop, and it really can interfere with their functioning.
Well, it strikes me because I hate to be tickled, and I hate it as a child, and my son is that way, I think. But that's one thing to not like to be tickled. It's another thing if the tickling, if you're so ticklish that you can't even be near someone or it's impacting your relationship because of being so tickly. So, you know, my heart certainly goes out to this listener.
Some suggestions. Some people use medications that could be antidepressants or anti-anxiety medicines that could be helpful.
I wonder about biofeedback. Have you thought about that, Adam?
Yeah, there is some research on biofeedback or even what's called mindfulness meditation as being helpful, unlike cognitive behavioral therapy, which may not actually work so well with this particular type of condition.
Well, we certainly wish you the best and hope that people stop tickling you.
Thank you. Let's listen to our very last house call.
I have diabetes, and I recently lost 20 pounds as my doctor recommended. When I returned to see my doctor, she said that my HbA1c was low, so she told me to stop taking my medication. I thought that it was good to have your test levels be low, and I feel great. I'm afraid if I stop the medication, my sugars might run high again.
Well, congratulations, good for you for losing the weight. I mean, 20 pounds is significant, and in this case, if that's what tipped you sort of out of that range of needing medication for your diabetes, then that is something to be really proud of.
Yeah, and chances are really good. It was a combination of your weight loss and the medication, but you should take probably more of the credit here. And if your hemoglobin A1C, that average blood sugar level, is at the very lowest end of normal, it suggests that you really may not need that medication, at least not now.
I would encourage you to stop the medicine as your doctor suggests and then come back in a few months and recheck it just to be sure that it's running low or in a normal range without needing the medication.
Ditto, Christy. Absolutely. Well, that'll conclude our house calls for today, and we want to thank everyone for sending us great questions. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health, and you can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu.
And we want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Heather Walker. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
Happy Your Health. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.
Scarlet, it's over. I'm leaving.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go and what shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, chapelboro.com. You can find photo galleries, daily columns, news and sports, Chapelboro's best, all that and more every day.
Oh, Rhett, with the comprehensive community calendar as my witness, I will never go hungry again.